funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to put a killer to rest once and for all? When Dr. D.A. Henderson entered medical school, smallpox had largely ceased to be a threat in the United States, but it still infected 10 million people a year in other parts of the world and killed about 2 million. Throughout human history, the smallpox death toll is estimated in the hundreds of millions. So even with the vaccine proven to protect people from the disease, many scientists believed it would be all but impossible to wipe it out completely. My guest today led the World Health Organization effort that did it in a single decade. Dr. D.A. Henderson is professor of medicine and public health at the University of Pittsburgh, former dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the National Science Medal. He was even knighted by the King of Thailand. His new book is called Smallpox, The Death of a Disease, The Inside Story of Eradicating a Worldwide Killer. D.A., welcome to Think.
Delighted to be with you.
So you went through medical school with no intention of going into epidemiology. You wanted to be a cardiologist. How did you end up in this line of work?
Well, I wound up in it because we had to serve uniform duty time at some point, and I'd been deferred for a long time. And one of the options you had was to serve in the public health service, and there was something called the Epidemic Intelligence Service. So I thought, well, all right. Let's give it a try.
You thought you'd tough it out for 2 years and then be on to what you really wanted to do.
I was convinced I would. Mm-hmm. Instead, I got so absorbed with the adventures that were there and the opportunities to do some interesting things that I just never left.
Yeah, and you call yourself a shoe leather epidemiologist. You realized from the beginning that it was critical to work in the field and not just behind a desk or in a lab. Can you talk about what made that so important?
Well, I think any job I've been in since, it's important to be out and talking with the people who are really doing the job. And certainly, in terms of an epidemic, and you've got cases out in the community, it's important to talk with them, find out what they might have done, what ideas they might have, what happened. And you find an immense amount of information that's there that you won't get in just sort of printed paper coming through. It requires your being out there in the field.
So let's get some information about smallpox itself. What do we know for sure about its history in the human population?
Well, it's an interesting history because smallpox can only infect man. That is, it has to go from person to person to person. So there's no animal reservoir, and then it sort of makes a chain. You can think of it as a chain. Now, we can trace back smallpox at least 3,500 years ago because there are four mummies that died with smallpox, and you can see the mummies with their lesions of smallpox. So that we figure that we have at least 3,500 years and probably as much as 10,000 years that this virus has been afflicting man.
And some cultures so feared the disease that they created smallpox deities to pray to or to sacrifice things to.
Smallpox is very unique, and in fact, the only disease for which there are deities in different cultures. It was so much feared. So there are deities in Japan, in China, in India, in Africa.
I know that there are different forms of smallpox. Can you talk about what makes the disease so very dangerous?
Well, the serious type of smallpox called the variola major is a disease which infects the individual. You get it by sort of droplet from a patient. You inhale it, and then everything is quiet for as much as 10 to 12 days. And then the individual gets a fever and usually has aching pains, feels miserable, goes to bed, and then little lesions, little pimples begin appearing on the face, in the mouth, and the tongue. They begin to swell with pus. It's like having boils all over the skin, very painful. The individual has trouble eating. He has trouble drinking because of the lesions in his mouth. And about 3 in 10 of the people that get the disease will die from it.
Are there any theories as to why some people survive smallpox who are infected and others do not?
Well, there's some effect here in terms of the nutrition of the individual, in terms of what his immunity status is or how his immune system functions. But it varies like many other diseases. Some of them seem to cause more trouble than others with different people.
Let's talk about how we defend ourselves against it. Most people are familiar with the story of Edward Jenner in the 18th century, but he was not the first person to try to inoculate against smallpox.
Well, it was a type of activity going on for a long, long time back and called variolation. People in several cultures found that if you could take a little bit of pus from a patient and inoculate it into the skin of somebody who had not had the disease, that that individual would get a milder form of smallpox. And the death rate there was about 2% as opposed to 30% if you got it by the natural route. So for a long time in several cultures, they used this method. The only trouble with it was that the individual who had been variolated, as we called it, could cause and spread it to others and cause a regular outbreak. So in some countries, we had variolators working, and you could follow their course as outbreak after outbreak occurred on village after village where they had been. So it was a protection for some, but it was also a huge hazard for others.
And the great leap forward that Jenner took was in recognizing that another disease that was similar but not nearly as dangerous, cowpox, could transmit the same kind of immunity to smallpox.
It's a wonderful story, really, because the lore in the British countryside was that the milkmaids did not have the scarring because they didn't get smallpox. And at that time, 70-80% of those who got smallpox would have bad scarring on the face. And so the literature talks about the wonderful complexion of the dairy maid. It had nothing to do with the drinking milk. It had a lot to do with the fact she didn't get the smallpox because she got this infection from the cows, of milking the cows, that protected against the disease of smallpox. It was the world's first vaccine, and those who practice immunology date the beginning of their specialty from that act.
So how close are the current vaccine formulations that we would use today to the one that Jenner pioneered?
Well, we don't really know. We do feel, however, from a good deal of indirect evidence, that it's rather different. And we're not quite sure why and how it became what it is, but it is still referred to as cowpox, but it looks very different from the cowpox that we can now isolate. So whatever it is, it's been very effective, and it's been passed along and produced now for 175 years, so that it's proven to be pretty effective.
There was another huge technological advance in 20th century vaccination. Benjamin Rubin invented this thing called the bifurcated needle. Can you talk about what made that so revolutionary?
Well, the way that we had vaccinated people was to put a little drop of the vaccine on the skin and then scratch through it. In Europe, they scratched through it, and we used the sort of point of a pin or a needle and sort of pressed the vaccine into the skin, because it had to grow to protect, and had to grow, and then the body reacted by producing antibodies for protection. This man, Ben Rubin, who was working for Wyeth Laboratories at the time, said, well, suppose we take this needle and have two points on it, and you just dip it into the vaccine, and the vaccine will hold right between those two little points. And we suggested, well, rather than sort of trying to poke it in gently, and which was very difficult, let's just sort of do 15 little pricks rapidly in the skin to see what happened. And we got marvelous results. 100% of the vaccinations were taking. It was very effective. The vaccine that was required for this was only about a fourth of what we had to use for the scratch method. And more than that, we could teach villagers to vaccinate in 15 minutes. So they got you get a supply of these needles and had them made of stainless steel, and The amazing thing was you could use them over and over again. You just boiled them in between, and they would last for hundreds of vaccinations. We didn't have very much money for the program, and these cost only $5 for 1,000. That was really a remarkable bargain.
Dr. D.A. Henderson is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Smallpox, The Death of a Disease. How were smallpox cases distributed globally at the time that, you were tapped to start working on this?
When we started working on it, it was in Brazil and most countries of Africa south of the Sahara Desert, and then a large block of countries in South Asia, like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. In all, there were about 31 countries that had smallpox at the time, and somewhere around 1.2 billion people.
Hmm. And one of the problems that you had initially was that the cases were not necessarily well documented. They weren't always reported to World Health officials.
Now, this is right. The countries are supposed to report on a regular basis about certain diseases, and smallpox and cholera and yellow fever were three of these, but they didn't do it very often. And the data that came in provided you little idea of what was really going on around the countries. So what we did was to try to develop in each country a reporting system so that they would have each hospital and each health center would report every week whether they had cases of smallpox or not and how many cases they had. And this made a huge difference because then we could know where it was and we could know to put our resources in one area as opposed to another and try to stop outbreaks.
And another really interesting and novel approach that you took was going into schools because your staffers discovered that, young children or children that were, you know, 10 or 12 years old usually were aware of whether there were smallpox cases in their villages.
Yes, this was an amazing discovery, and it's sort of a result of doing shoe leather epidemiology. In this case, I was simply going out in Indonesia and meeting with the local people and the vaccinators and asking them what they were doing. And at this point, they were going from house to house, and they had a little picture of smallpox, showing it to the people. Do you know anybody that has the disease like this? Well, there was one fellow in the group who were involved with the search who would be the last to leave in the morning, and he'd be the first back at night, and he would have a whole list of villages that were infected. We said, how in heaven's name do you get this? He said, well, I just go into the schoolrooms, and I show the children the picture and the teachers there, and it's amazing. As he found out, children between about 8 and 12 years of age seem to know everything that's going on. And they were just remarkable in reporting what was happening.
Were there attempts by places sometimes to conceal cases of smallpox?
Yeah, we had a certain problem. There were a couple of countries where if a man, let's say a district health officer, were to report cases from his particular district, then they would punish him. Because their accusation was, well, if you vaccinated everybody in your district, you wouldn't have any cases. That's all very nice, but vaccinating 100% of any population is just impossible. So they reported cases many times. They would then punish them by transferring them to an unhappy, miserable post somewhere. And so they didn't report.
My guest is Dr. D.A. Henderson. He is professor of medicine and public health at the University of Pittsburgh. His new book is called Smallpox, The Death of a Disease. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. D.A. Henderson, who headed the World Health Organization's successful effort to eradicate the disease of smallpox from the world population. His new book is called Smallpox, The Death of a Disease. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Going back to the story of having to sort of ferret out these cases, there was one time when one of your field workers really suspected that there must be smallpox in a village, and so he drove his car deliberately into a mud puddle?
Yes, this is right. It happened in Somalia, and the government was trying to hide cases. They didn't want reports of cases. This had been communicated to the people in the villages and what have you. So this young Sudanese driver that we'd hired for the program decided there's one way to find out, and he took over the car and drove it deep into a mud bath where he couldn't get out. And the villagers came out to help pull the car out, and with this he found four or five cases of smallpox.
It's amazing the kind of ingenuity and really on-the-spot thinking that had to take place. There were places where you needed to keep cases isolated or the people around them isolated, but they were concerned that they wouldn't have money to eat if they couldn't go out and work. And so some of the funds that you had to pay for things like food.
Yes, each of the people working in the field, we gave them a certain account, that is a certain amount of money, which they would spend and then come back later and tell us how much they'd spend and give us the receipts. And all of a sudden we had a movement. One of the investigators said, all right, we are having trouble because the people with smallpox are being taken out into the market to be exhibited as a subject of sympathy and for begging. So he put two and two together, and he said, well, suppose I give you the money, and you keep him here so that he doesn't have to go and beg, and we'll pay for the food and what have you. Well, it caused a bit of a problem back at headquarters. You know, what are we going to do? Are we feeding all of the people, all of the bangers in India? And no, we're not. There are some circumstances where this is very necessary.
So it strikes me as a very important thing that you hired the right people. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to who you wanted to be working for you?
Yeah, it seemed to me that younger people would do a good job. If they're bright, interested, motivated, willing to work in very difficult circumstances, they're probably going to do better than some of the older people, say in their 50s or 60s, where they would have to put up with more things than they could possibly deal with. So we made it an effort to try to attract younger people into the program, and we were really pleased to get the ones we did. They're really exceptional people. We had in all some 73 different nationalities. But one of the important things, I think, was that they didn't know that the job was impossible. And so they really looked at each of these challenges and went about solving it one way or another and would not take no for an answer.
Did you have to believe from the beginning, despite what the prevailing scientific theory was, that it was in fact possible?
Well, I thought it was possible, at least in theory possible. Certainly we'd gotten rid of it in the United States and we'd gotten rid of it in Europe. And so in theory, we should be able to stop the spread of smallpox and eradicate it. What I didn't have a full appreciation of is just how many things we would run into, real problems, from civil wars to famine, flood, massive numbers of refugees moving from place to place. And I must say, we sort of solved the problems one barrier at a time, and we'd had confronted with too many of them at one time, I think we really would have despaired. But at any rate, we managed to make our way through and saw the last case in 1977.
When that happened, and then I suppose it took some time to make sure that nothing else was going to pop up, was it almost hard for you to believe that this was over, that it had been done?
Well, it was. no doubt about it. And we'd actually had a, had gone 6 weeks without a case in Ethiopia, and we were about ready to announce to the press and everybody that we've seen the last case. We think we have. And all of a sudden, two cases showed up in Somalia. And after that, I think we were very cautious about being too optimistic that we really had the last case. But eventually, we got to the point. This one man who was a cook in the hospital had been a vaccinator. He wasn't vaccinated. Been a cook in the hospital. He's supposed to be vaccinated there. Wasn't vaccinated. He came down with the disease, and they misdiagnosed it as chicken pox. I mean, everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong with the last case. But sure enough, he turned out to be the last case, and October 26, 1977.
On the other hand, I have to wonder, you were still quite a young man at the time. After having achieved what people thought was impossible, was there part of you that was wondering what in the world could be next?
Well, in truth, I was sort of wrapping up with the smallpox, and we were, my deputy was beginning to take over, which I thought was good. And I suddenly got a call to become dean at a school of public health, which happened to be Johns Hopkins. Well, it was a little bit of a problem because I'd never been on a faculty, let alone being a dean. But it looked very challenging, and they talked me into coming to be a dean. And so that was the next thing. And I wound up at the White House for 4 years, advising President George Herbert Walker Bush. And that came quite out of the blue, and it was just as I was finishing up being dean. So it's sort of been one thing after another. There's not been time enough to sit back and think, well, what do I do next? There's something very challenging that's always just come over the horizon.
Dr. D.A. Henderson is my guest. His new book is called Smallpox, The Death of a Disease. Let's speak to Jacob in Dallas. Hi, Jacob.
Hi.
Go ahead, please. Fine, thank you.
My name is Jacob, and I was born in Africa. And during the period where smallpox was actually killing most of the children back in Cameroon, and the work that they did was pretty significant to actually try to help and cure the disease as much as it was rampant in Cameroon during that time.
Jacob, maybe you can...
They went from villages to villages, tried to gather people and to schools to teach the children how to identify and report the disease to the healthcare facilities that were available. So we did a good job, and we are happy today in Africa that most of those diseases that killed most of the children are no longer in existence. So my hat, my cap, and my hat off to him for the job they did. And I pray that it should continue to focus on such an endeavor to help the African, the continent of Africa as a whole and the world in general. So thank you very much, Doctor, for what you did.
Jacob, very quickly, can you talk briefly about what it was like to grow up in a place where you had reason to be afraid of catching smallpox?
Well, it was like a taboo if you had smallpox growing up in those days. And if you were infected, you were quarantined in an environment where nobody could even come closer to you. You were not only taken away from school where we found most of our pleasures and happiness, you were sent to an area just, you know, where you cannot be reached by anybody. So it was a taboo, but with the education that we received, it made it possible for us to understand that this was a disease and can be cured. So that's what we gained. That was the difference that we realized growing up in a period where smallpox was actually rampant.
I really appreciate you calling. Thanks so much, Jacob. It sounds like, D.A., that he may have actually encountered some members of your team when he was a kid.
I often do encounter people who worked with us. The thing that's interesting is that we never had more than 150 international staff. And so there's the world being as big as it is and as populous as it is, that our job was really to be sort of catalytic or to help the countries and the local people do the job. And they turned out to be remarkably well. And I think Jacob was one of those who was out there searching for cases and and perhaps vaccinating as well.
Obviously, there is nothing good about smallpox, was nothing good, but a couple of things worked in your favor as an epidemiologist trying to eliminate this, one of which is that there is no animal reservoir, as you mentioned earlier, and the fact that, as I understand it, people who have smallpox are not really contagious until they are obviously ill. Can you talk about how that differentiates it from some other diseases that many people would like to see also wiped off the face of the earth?
It made a very big difference that people with smallpox didn't transmit it until they just began to develop a rash. And this is very different from, for example, with influenza. You can transmit the virus for at least a day, sometimes 2 days, before you get sick. So you're out circulating around. You don't know you're sick, but you're transmitting it to others. And the same is true for measles and several other diseases. So with smallpox, however, once you developed that rash, you felt terrible. And many of these people just took to their bed and didn't go out and circulate.
And that allowed you, if you identified a case, to sort of vaccinate in a ring around the sick person or sick people.
Right. This was the key thing in the program. One was to keep track of the cases and try to learn about where they all are, get that information promptly, and then send out a team, we called it a containment team, of two or three people to go to the place where the outbreak is and to vaccinate all of the people in a ring around that area so that there's no place for no people for the virus to infect. So that, in other words, you stop the spread right there, and basically what you're doing is cutting a chain of spread by stopping it at that point. And it was called surveillance containment, and the teams were often called firefighting teams for obvious reasons. And this has made the big difference between what we did from 1967 onwards from what had been done before. Beforehand, the governments put a lot of emphasis on vaccinating huge numbers of people and not paying much attention to where the cases were. So that we had a lot of data that were coming into the World Health Organization telling us how many millions, tens of millions of cases are vaccinated, people are vaccinated, but with no information as to how it was spreading and were we really getting a much lower number of cases.
Did you ever have a field worker come down with the disease?
We never did, no.
It's remarkable.
We tried to make sure they were all vaccinated, that was for sure. And the vaccine is so protective. It's, for example, if you take poliomyelitis, it takes you at least 3-4 doses or injections before you're protected. With smallpox, it was just one. And that made a big difference.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Bruce in Fort Worth. Hi, Bruce.
Hey. My question regards to the mutation rate of viruses. It's my understanding that the current swine flu virus has already mutated many, many times, and it sounds like smallpox was very stable as far as mutation rate. I'm just curious to know about that, and I'll listen on the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
He's absolutely right. We have a lot of problems trying to get a flu vaccine that matches up very closely with the virus, the strain that's in circulation at any given time. And the flu virus keeps changing year by year by year. The smallpox virus was very stable, and it's sort of as far back as we can go. It's pretty much the same sort of cowpox vaccine that seemed to protect against the human smallpox. We had a disease called monkeypox that protected against that. So it was a very much easier. We didn't have to change the vaccine strain every year or at all, as a matter of fact.
What do we know about why people in the New World seem to have much greater mortality from smallpox than people who caught the disease in Europe and Asia?
This is one of the remarkable events, and little known is the fact that the settlement of America was largely dependent on smallpox affecting the American Native American Indians. And they would have death rates and outbreaks, as we've gotten that from missionaries and others, 60 to 80% of the people, when they had an outbreak, would die. And often there were not enough people to provide food for the remainder of the group, and whole tribes vanished. So that what we feel happened is that smallpox, we guess, probably came into being with man maybe 10,000 years ago when their first villages began to form. And the people then, ever since, all of us, have been, their ancestors have been subjected to smallpox, and some are going to be more resistant than others, and there would be a genetic selection, if you will, to for those who were more resistant. But the Native Americans came across the land bridge 25,000 years ago, and our belief is that they had had no exposure to it, and therefore they were fully susceptible to the virus. And the stories of death among the Native Americans is just incredible.
We have an email here from Leonard in Arlington who says, while I am glad for the work to eliminate this disease, I'm wondering on a philosophical level, are we tampering with the survival of the fittest evolutionary purpose?
Well, in this case, I certainly don't think this is a problem. And we, to take a disease out of circulation here like this, I don't think this is a problem. Evolution is going on in many, many different ways, and I think this would not have a material impact on humankind.
Dr. D.A. Henderson is my guest. He is professor of medicine and public health at the University of Pittsburgh currently. His new book is called Smallpox, The Death of a Disease. You can join us on the air by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. D.A. Henderson, who headed the World Health Organization's team that eliminated smallpox in about a decade. His new book is called Smallpox, The Death of a Disease. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Your preference would have been, once the disease was declared eradicated, to destroy the samples that remained of the virus. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The thought was that if they ever escaped from a laboratory, there would be a lot of difficulties because we've stopped vaccinating. And so that as time has gone on, we've had more and more susceptible people, and the escape of smallpox from a laboratory could be really result in a disastrous situation.
That didn't happen, as we know, and there were essentially two repositories. Can you talk about where they were?
Yeah, there are two, one in Moscow and one in Atlanta, Georgia, with the Communicable Disease Center. These are the two laboratories that had worked very closely with the program and doing diagnostic work and doing research. And as we got toward the end of the numbers of cases, we thought we would try to persuade governments and laboratories to destroy any specimens they had, or to transfer them to one of these two locations. And just as we were beginning in this effort, a serious event happened in Birmingham, England, where a particular scientist was working with smallpox, and some of it got into the air and went to a floor above, and a woman up there who was working as a photographer got ill and, in fact, died. And with that, I think that the risk and danger of this became apparent to countries around the world, and many of them tried to persuade their laboratories to destroy the virus. We finally just came down to the two, and since that time, there's been a lot of discussion, should we keep it or not, and isn't it something wrong here if we're destroying a particular species? And this has been discussed by all sorts of different groups, good virologists and biologists, about what are the ethics of this, and should we do it? And it's still up in the air as to, there's some who feel we really want to keep it just in case. Some would like to have said we maybe should develop a better vaccine or an antiviral agent. But, of course, if we don't have any smallpox, we're not going to be using the vaccine and nor having to use antiviral drugs.
So fast forward to 2001. You mentioned that you worked for President George H.W. Bush. You were also called in to consult the second Bush administration after 9/11, when there was so much concern that, that smallpox might be weaponized against the United States.
Yes, this was a very worrisome period, because there was intelligence intercepts picked up the indication that there might be a second event. And it was hinted that the second event would probably be biological. And meanwhile, we've had discussions with the Russians, who had continued working with smallpox as a biological agent. So this was secret work, and that became a known. And at that point, we met with the people who were primarily responsible for this and work, and what were the organisms they were most concerned with, and what were they doing their most work with? Right at the top of the list was smallpox. So we were desperately concerned, and at that time, we checked to see what we had in the way of vaccine, because no one had produced any vaccine since 1978. That's nearly 25 years before. We had, as we discovered, some vaccine that we'd kept in storage and deep freeze. But when we checked on how much this was, and this was about 5 days after the 9/11, we had 90,000 doses. And we knew at that time, if we had an outbreak, we wouldn't begin to be able to control it, smallpox, without a lot more vaccine than that. We talked with manufacturers, and they had said, doing everything they possibly could, it would be 5 years before we could have more vaccine. So this became a major concern of mine and of my staff, to get smallpox vaccine in quantity. And we were successful in doing it. We managed to get 200 million doses inside of just 18 months. And I must say, I rested much easier, and many of us did as well. But the concern we have is that at some point, it may be possible that somebody gets their hands on some smallpox and distributes it, or starts some outbreaks, in which case we would really, it would be a serious tragedy.
But you didn't think, even at the time when there might be another attack imminent, that it was a good idea to vaccinate anybody who wanted to be vaccinated until some cases showed up?
Yes, well, this was a very difficult time. I think Vice President Cheney was convinced that we should vaccinate the entire country. And the difficulty with smallpox vaccine is that it causes, for everybody, they get a sore in their arm, they get some fever, and feel not too well for 2 or 3 days, but a certain number of people get really sick. And we could count on perhaps having to 1 million people of having probably 20 needing hospital care, and one in 1 million dying. So if we vaccinated 100 million people even, we'd have 100 deaths and a great many people going into the hospital. Well, the vaccine, I think we took it and administered it freely when we had the risk of smallpox, because the reactions were very small compared to a risk of 30% death if you contracted smallpox. But when you don't have the disease around, this it looks and is a vaccine which is much more reactogenic, as we call it, causes many more serious reactions than any other vaccine we have. And I think trying to, I wasn't persuaded that it was a good thing to do, because we've got this technique of surveillance and containment. We find some cases, and even if somebody's released it, we've got the vaccine. We can contain it as we did in the during the campaign and stop the spread. So rather than trying to vaccinate all the people in the country, we felt we should be better prepared to detect at an earlier time an outbreak should it occur and have vaccine ready to go and ready to move out. And that's where we are today.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Royce City, where we'll speak with Peter. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I'd like to thank Dr. Henderson for all his work in eradicating polio. I remember those jabs that I used to get in back in the 60s and 70s for international travel. But right now, I was just wondering whether Dr. Henderson has any comments on the where the world stands with the eradication of another disease in that area, poliomyelitis. I think that's almost gone, but maybe not from parts of Africa right now.
Yes, the polio is down now to really about four countries where it's continually spreading. We call it endemic. But they're very difficult countries. It's Afghanistan, where, as you know, in the southern part of Afghanistan, it's very insecure. It's in Pakistan, and a number of the cases are up along the tribal areas where much of the fighting is going on. It's in India, in some very densely populated states, which are very poor and very difficult to work. And Nigeria, where there's been religious objections to vaccination, which has held up the vaccination program. But there's a lot of optimism at this point in time on the part of Rotary International, which has made many huge contributions to this. And the United Nations Children's Fund has played a big role, and a lot of other people, and hoping to get to that point where we'd have no more polio. But it's a very difficult task, and they've been doing this now. It's just over 20 years trying to eradicate it. And I think there's a fatigue taking hold, both in the people that still have the polio and some of the workers. So I'm hopeful they might eradicate it, but it's going to be tough.
I wonder if you can talk about your thoughts on this movement in the United States wherein people feel that vaccinations themselves may actually be more dangerous, in many cases in terms of their children, and whether there are enough people who feel this way now that they could actually threaten the sort of herd immunity that we've developed to a variety of diseases.
Well, at this time, I don't think we have that much resistance in the U.S., but your point is well taken that if we did rate of vaccination goes down to a certain level, we are apt to have epidemics. And this has happened. It happened in Japan. It happened in Britain, where there were great concern about the vaccine. I don't think it was warranted, but that was the view that many took. And they stopped accepting the whooping cough vaccine. Well, the net effect was, after a while, they had huge epidemics of whooping cough, and which, though, that is a very serious disease. And I think we have that risk with both measles and German measles, which we're getting to very low levels, that we might be in the position with importations to get those diseases established again. And so I think this it's too bad, but I can see where a parent says, look, we've got no measles around here at all, and I don't see why my children should be vaccinated at this point. And maybe there's some reactions that would be serious, so I will not have my child vaccinated. Well, if there are too many that take that attitude, the disease is going to come back, and it will be very serious.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Anita in Dallas. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I thought I heard a report, maybe in the 1980s, of some scientist doctor who had been working with the smallpox virus in a lab and that it had escaped and infected a couple of people, or he was afraid it would, and he was so distraught that he committed suicide. Was that a rumor, or did it happen? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. That's the Birmingham case, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was 1978. It was in Birmingham. And this is a very good scientist. But a labyrinth virus did escape and infected this one woman. And she died. Her mother got the disease. Her father had a heart attack and died. And the scientist was so distraught that he took his own life.
What do the responses to the SARS and now the swine flu outbreaks indicate to you about our preparedness to handle new viruses that emerge as pandemics?
Well, we're not as well prepared as we need to be. There's no question about that. And yet, the thing of it is that people really don't recognize when you're going to have a catastrophe until, or what you need for a catastrophe until it's really too late. Right after 9/11 and the anthrax attack, there was really a lot of interest, concern, and people at all levels working very hard to develop the community preparedness. And then it eased off because nothing else came along quite like it until SARS. But that was pretty limited, and it wasn't a very big area that was affected. You're in Toronto, of course. You were pretty aware of it, but most places weren't aware of it. And then we've had the pandemic flu, and again, there's been a reawakening of interest in terms of thinking, yes, we better, if we have a major pandemic, we're going to have to be much better prepared to take care of patients, to do a number of things that than what we are right now. So I think it's been up and down in terms of interest, and it's always very difficult to keep an entire community and the leadership really interested and concerned when something isn't happening or is very definitely going to happen within just the next year or two.
In the 10 seconds or so we have left, is WHO, does it have the resources it needs to do its job properly?
No, it does not. The WHO could be substantially larger and could contribute a very great deal more.
Dr. D.A. Henderson headed the WHO team that eliminated the smallpox virus. His new book is called Smallpox, The Death of a Disease. It has been such an honor to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.